right now, it's my great pleasure to welcome Robin Shepherd to the studio. Very good afternoon to you, Robert.
And good afternoon to you.
Now, you've written a book. It's called A Solitary Confinement, which is a most extraordinary tale of somebody who has gone through a life experience that many of us perhaps are fortunate enough not to have to go through, which is you were an extremely successful businessman, and then unexpectedly you found yourself with a rare disease that laid you up in a way that just almost overnight simply changed your life.
Indeed.
How, let's go back to the beginning, before the disease set in, what were you doing as a businessman?
I'd been in hotels for many, many years. I was presiding over a group of about 14 independent hotels, mainly in the south of England. And specifically before this illness hit me, I had been negotiating a deal to buy a private members club in London, which is called Home House in Portman Square. And
I know it well.
Very groovy it is too. And we'd got right to the vinegar strokes of the deal, and I developed a dry cough. And like most men, you think women are going to be cross with me if I say it's anything more than a dry cough, because we do man flu and all that sort of stuff. So I kind of dismissed it. Big mistake. And so in a very short space of time from the purchase of this business, I went from this first sense of feeling ill into a creeping paralysis, which came through my fingertips and toes.
How quick was that from the dry cough to the paralysis?
It was about 2 days. And that's from the first symptom arriving to falling on the floor and simply being unable to move and get up again.
If you had not been, I don't know, sort of manly about this cough, is there anything that could have been done to stop it, do you think?
Possibly I could have gotten into hospital a little bit earlier, but it would have been fractional, and the pace of this is such. It affects about 1,000 people a year in the UK. It's called Guillain-Barré syndrome. It was discovered by two French scientists, one called Guillain and the other called Barré, who diagnosed this syndrome and quickly realised that out of that sort of 1,000 in the UK, about 80% of those would have a partial paralysis, which tends to come much more slowly. Because I'm in catering, I unfortunately picked the go large version, which hit me much more quickly, and it took the whole of my immune system out. If you'd like me to go on, I'll tell you a little bit more.
I'd like you to tell me more about it, because I think for all of us listening to you, understanding an illness that comes this rapidly and has that much of an impact. Mm. First of all, there's the story from you in respect of how it changed your life immediately, that having gone from, I mean, just to understand even how great your life was before this happened, and it's tough to, I mean, you're here now, so I don't feel too bad about asking you, but you're running 14 independent hotels, you're buying one of London's top private members club. Yeah. Things are groovy. I mean, just describe to me a little bit about how groovy your life was, maybe in terms of the sorts of people you met, the sorts of things that you did, just so that we understand how much of a change all of this is and how difficult it is to put into perspective.
I guess a lot of the hotels that I'm responsible for running are the ones that people save long and hard to go and stay in at weekends and reward themselves. Well, I get to play in those playgrounds every day of the week. If I want an extra slice of foie gras, I've only got to ask. It's there. It's a kind of millionaire's lifestyle, even though you're working most of the time. You just bypass the need to become one along the way, I suppose. It's a little bit easy. It's a short circuit.
Are you
circuit.
Trying to tell me that you didn't make your not only your fame, but also your fortune from working in these hotels? You must have done all right.
The business is thankfully still going strong, and Home House continues to go from strength to strength, which we're grateful about. And I'm, without sounding too patronising, my fellow directors have done a pretty good job coping. Some would say they did a lot better without me there in the business than when I was, but I'd like to think that's not the case.
And have you left that business altogether now?
No, I've come back to work. Possibly before I talk about that, I should explain the illness a little bit more, because for the listeners to understand, you have to appreciate that here's a reasonably alpha male, used to making decisions, having a lot of autonomy in his business life, and suddenly his body says, had enough, we're packing in, the immune system attacks itself. If you can imagine the domestic wiring in your house is a series of grey insulated wires around the copper inside, that is called the myelin sheath in the body. That's what gets attacked by this illness, and it leaves the nerves to short-circuit each other and just go into mayhem and panic.
But the reason I wanted to ask you about whether or not you've gone back to work is there's a time scale. So how, when did this first happen? When did you
first... This first happened to me Christmas 2004. We're 3 years on. I've been back at work in increasing levels over the last year and a half, and it was very much sort of a couple of hours a week to begin with. I'm now much more substantially in the business. I get tired. My fingers and my toes still don't talk to me in the way that they used to, but I have a quality of life which I'm very grateful for by comparison.
So it's pretty much three years that you were
yes,
laid out
of? Yes, it is, and the calendar for anybody who suffers this illness is normally somewhere between 2 and 7 years for the recovery, so it's a bit of a bitch in terms of its longevity.
I can imagine. I mean, talk to me about the psychological impact of this happening. When it first happened to you, what were your immediate thoughts?
Well, you have no idea what's happening to you, so you just want knowledge, you want reassurance, you want someone to say, oh, that's what's wrong with you, we've dealt with this before. That took, I suppose, 5 or 6 days for them to be sure what had happened to me. You can imagine that I was quickly taken into intensive care and was surrounded by fabulous equipment and even more fabulous people who looked after me. I'm enormously grateful for the swiftness of their attention and their
And you go into some detail talking about the, I suppose, the struggle and the fight that you have, that psychologically dealing with this, that suddenly one day you're busy doing your business dealings and having a lot of fun and enjoying yourself, yep, the challenges, and a few days later you're in a hospital surrounded by technology, you've got things and the uncertainty of what's going on, and then even when you get the certainty as to what you've got, again, I'm assuming that your brain, even though your body's messing around with you, your brain is pretty much functioning as normal.
Brain, as normal as it ever was before the illness, I think the brain...
I use normal in a glib though, but I would never like somebody to describe it as normal, because I think normal is dull. But, I mean, right, functioning as it should.
I believe my brain was functioning as pretty close to normal as possible. However, just to give you some idea, you are unable to move any part of your body. The breathing has collapsed, you're on a ventilator. You can stare at the ceiling occasionally, because your eyes continue to gum up, and you have to have a pipette with a certain sort of eye drop put into there just to open your eyes up. It's a transitory thing, so the eye just seals back over again. So imagine your hearing is just on maximum volume and every other sense is denied you, pretty much. So it's pretty scary, and people talk about the psychological impact. Well, you're more concerned with breathing and how am I eventually going to get food into my system and where does the next drink going to come from than you are about, isn't this a terrible situation to be in?
How long was it before you moved away from that complete paralysis to having a little bit of autonomy over your, not only your mind, but also your body as well?
I think the correlation was with the breathing, really. I was ventilated for 6 weeks and completely unable to move in that time. I became an expert at staring at ceilings, and I do find when I meet people now, I tend to look upwards and look around the room much more.
I will watch out for that. If you start staring at the ceiling, then I know that maybe something's gone wrong.
It's a very, very sad hobby, but there we are, each to his own. So 6 weeks of
you
really
don't find yourself comparing ceilings to the quality of ceilings.
Quietly, very, very quietly.
But isn't it? But again, it's the psychology of. I'm assuming you have to be a really strong person to get yourself through thinking, I will get better. I will have a chance to recover. This isn't my life for the rest of my life, but I have to do this in order to get through to the other side.
Well, I have to say some of the expert medical advice was not that encouraging. I was certainly advised that I was almost certainly never going to walk again. So you have to take a view. Am I going to fight that, or am I just going to accept that as my fate?
Well, clearly here you are today. You walked in today, so I'm assuming that you did fight that.
Yes, it has been that, but I'm enormously grateful to family and friends and all the professionals who've helped me and urged me on. And there are various characters. I mean, for instance, the first hospital I was in, they have a professor of pain. Now, I know there's a lot of your listeners who would pay good money to visit a professor of pain, but possibly in different circumstances. This particular professor of pain talked me through the survival process. He kind of gave me this elixir or this roadmap and said, this is how you plot your course. And just in terms of the sort of life-changing maxim for me, I suppose this knowledge that there's always someone worse off than you are is writ large in my mind now. And in terms of the way that you deal with something like this, it just literally has to be one small goal at a time. And you just get very, very used to breaking your time down and saying, what's the next thing on my list? What's the
schedule? What was your first goal?
Believe it or not, the first goal was to learn how to sit up. I resembled an egg without a carton. Wherever gravity was, I'd just flop over that way. I had no strength in my core to enable me to do that. Once I'd got to that stage and was able to sit on the edge of a bed, then it was learning to stand, then it was learning to walk, then it was learning to climb stairs. I learnt that a little bit more quickly than I was able to get the use of my arms back. So you can imagine having two oven gloves on the end of your arms, which you can't connect with, but give you about as much information about things that you're touching or close to. So that was kind of weird. There was an extraordinary device called an OB Help Arm, which is a puppeteer's masterpiece, I suppose. It's a kind of Heath Robinson construction, which the specialist in the Wolfson Centre in Wimbledon put me into, which enables you to put your hands and your wrists into little pulleys with counterweights, and it allows you, like a puppeteer, to start moving your arms without any pressure or gravity kicking in. So bit by bit, I was able, through devices like that, to learn how to move my arms and feed myself again and things like that.
So you had to start, it sounds as if, almost from the beginning. And I suppose this is physically, as opposed to all the while your brain was working, that you never had to relearn. Did you have to relearn speech, for example?
Yes, I did have to relearn speech. The breathing was so compromised at the beginning, I found that I could only speak by breathing out. I couldn't project my voice as I was breathing in, so you've got to learn that. Then, of course, there's the pace, there's the timbre of the voice. I was really rather feminine for quite some time in terms of how I was talking to people. Couldn't project myself beyond the person sitting next to me. But eventually it returned, and you just keep working at it. Kind of confidence goes into hiding for a while, and your self-belief just gets so compromised. So you have to give yourself permission to start believing in yourself and other people again.
Absolutely. Now, we'll be coming back to talk a little bit more about not only your book, but also the story that, of course, goes with it in terms of your recovery and how you got that motivation and inspiration. And, of course, you'd like to call Robin and ask a question. 0845 60 60973 is the number to call, and you can text on 84850. Now, this is James Max in for Jenny Barnett here on London's LBC 97.3. Time now is just gone 2:45. And that means it's time to get the latest travel with Alan Joyce.
Thanks, James. All the roads in the centre of town have next. James
Max. I'm talking to Robin Shepherd about his book, A Solitary Confinement, which is an extraordinary tale of somebody who had a most extraordinary business career, looking after and managing some of, I don't know, the sort of hotels that you and I might, as he said, save up for. And managing those, and also Home House, which, of course, is one of London's premier private members' clubs. And then, unfortunately, you got... I'm going to pronounce it wrong, I'm sure. Guillain-Barré syndrome, is that correct?
Guillain-Barré.
Guillain-Barré.
Yeah.
Is that the anglicised way of pronouncing it? Barry? I don't know.
I'm told that officially that's the phonetic pronunciation. So the easy way to remember it is GBS, or Guillain-Barré syndrome.
I'm going to go for GBS. So you got GBS. How do you get GBS?
It's a lottery. There's no trigger which says that bad behaviour or too much alcohol or a poor diet or anything else is going to get it, and it's not a viral thing. It's just one of those things that you're programmed through, and it doesn't seem to be stress-related or any other trigger. It's a question of luck.
So you laid down with it, you ended up in hospital, in intensive care,
yep.
You lost the use of every limb, your ability to breathe freely, your ability to speak, your ability to move, everything.
Yeah.
And you had to relearn the lot. How, psychologically, of course, your brain is working throughout all this, and, yeah, and you're beginning to hear messages from doctors who say, well, you know, your recovery, this, that and the other, yeah, and you kind of have to build up your own resolve. Did you get your resolve internally or from family and friends? Who encouraged you?
It's a whole mixture. My partner Suzanne was indomitable in it and very practical. My children were incredibly supportive, but all sorts of well-wishers. Even my bank manager came to see me. Now, that really is scary. So I was hugely embarrassed and delighted to see the number of people who came to see me. And the concept that by going to see someone who's ill in hospital, a lot of people say, oh, I don't do hospitals, or it's not for me. I can assure you, if you're in there, that visit, never mind the grapes or anything else that you might be keen to take, just being there, listening and talking to someone is a real restorative.
So the flowers, the grapes, the presents, the cards, forget all that stuff. That doesn't mean so much to you. What meant
it's being there.
And particularly, I'm assuming, if you are really ill and unable to do anything. But what did people come and talk to you about? I mean, if, for example, you were unable to talk, was it just even being there?
Mm. Well, some people just seemed to have it off pat and knew what to tell me was going on elsewhere in the world and to pass comment on things. Some of my closer friends thought it would be great fun just to tease me and chide me at that point, and actually, knowing me sufficiently well, they were spot on. That was
I mean, did that make you giggle?
It did make me giggle. I couldn't shake any part of my body to reflect that. They just had to assume that I was giggling inside, and I was. But as things started to improve, so there's always this sense, well, I'm at rock bottom, I'm in the real basement here. There is only one way, which is up, and I have to believe that possibly by next week I might have a little bit more faculty back. Possibly the week after I might be able to do something else. So it was a voyage of discovery.
I'm assuming that just as you had positives and highs during the course of your recovery, mm. there must have been negatives and lows as well, perhaps as things perhaps regressed or you had a problem. What were, maybe if we can pick out one or two negative aspects so that we can understand what kind of resolve you have to push through those setbacks.
Well, I don't want to sound especially gruesome, but if you can imagine the point where your stomach has stopped working, the only way to get any form of nutrition into you is to stick a 60-centimetre tube through your left nostril and push it into the duodenum. And you're watching this taking place, and you're listening to the people talking about how it's going and how it's going on. You really want them to sort of get on with it. Then you know it's arrived. And then a nurse appears with this sickly, thick, green soup-like mixture in a syringe, a big syringe, and squirts it up your nostril.
No!
And that's lunch. So if you can imagine the contrast...
I can't imagine that at
you imagine
all.
The contrast of that, where as opposed to the sort of Michelin-style restaurants I've been very... fortunate to spend a lot of my previous life wandering around, then that was a sort of a low point. But the high points, eventually, as the pendulum swung, started to weigh it, and they were... You just appreciate different things in your day. The time when a lot of people engaged in work just rush off to the next meeting, another cup of coffee, keep going. That was denied me. I couldn't exist in that world.
Well, we'll come back to just discussing a little bit more about your extraordinary journey right after this. This is Robin Shepherd about his book, A Solitary Confinement, and we're talking about where you can get it from in a second. But time has rushed past. But when you think about the time that you've gone through, and now that you've perhaps defied many of the doctors and their predictions as to what you were going to achieve, I'm not going to be as glib as to say, do you take things or aspects from what has happened which give you inspiration going forward? But you must take some aspect of it into your life today, and it must have changed your personality, maybe even for the better.
Well, a lot of my work colleagues would say I was a lot more polite and say thank you more often than I used to, and that's a very good thing. It's inevitably the most humbling experience, and if I'd missed or not taken sufficient time to appreciate the halcyon parts of people's nature that do exist, I can tell you that spending that much time in hospitals and also in the rehabilitation centre in Wimbledon, you really do see this incredible heart that so many people who work to look after others have. And I'm blessed to have seen that.
And is your mission now either to heighten awareness of this particular disease, or is it more to perhaps heighten awareness of people like you who may at some point go through your life and have this happen to you, that there is a way out, there is light at the end of the tunnel?
I guess the answer to that is both. When I started to write the book, I was being selfish. I just wanted to be able to do something creative. If you can imagine, you've still got a body that's pretty inanimate, the brain is still working, you can't paint, you can't draw, you can't do wood carvings, you can't cook, there's nothing tactile that you can do. So a chum introduced me to some voice-activated software, and I just started to write a chronicle of what had happened. My son, bless him, fancies himself as a bit of an artist, so he gave me an old paintbrush and some rubber bands, which we stuck around my chin. So whenever I made mistakes and couldn't remember where to get the umlaut or the semicolon, I'd tap the answer in onto the keyboard by ducking my chin down with this paintbrush on the end, and eventually we fashioned a story. I'm hoping that there's enough in it now that people will say, that's very relevant because I know about this illness, or more, here's a kind of guide to getting over a real crisis in your life.
It's had some fairly amazing write-ups by some normally very harsh critics who have said, carry on writing. Are you going to continue writing?
Well, I thought about doing a work of fiction. I've just got the title at the moment, and that's as far as I get, because whenever I tell people what the title is, they just start giggling. I was going to call it A Gentleman's Relish. You see, you've started giggling too.
Then that's brilliant. Now, let me tell you, if you've been listening to Robin talk about his extraordinary story, the book is called A Solitary Confinement. We will make sure that on lbc.co.uk, if you go onto Jenny Barnett's page, you'll be able to get the book through Amazon, and we'll make sure that all the details are on the blog, lbc.co.uk. Robin, thank you so much for taking the time to join, and thank you also for telling us about the tough and difficult story, and it's wonderful to see you here with us today.